Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 8th of July, these are our main stories. The Brazilian president, Jair Bolsonaro, has tested positive for COVID-19 after repeatedly dismissing the seriousness of the virus. The director of the FBI has warned that covert Chinese operations pose the greatest threat to the future of the United States. Also in this podcast, I was the victim, not the perpetrator of domestic abuse. The Hollywood actor Johnny Depp has been giving evidence in a libel hearing. And the whiskey distiller who made hand sanitizer and drew inspiration from his grandma's approach 100 years ago.
She would soak her gauze mask in the rye whiskey and then put it on and then go into the hospital and treat those patients who were suffering from the Spanish influenza.
Coronavirus has caused more havoc in Brazil than almost any other country. 1.5 million people have caught it. More than 65,000 people have died. Right from the start of the outbreak, the president, Jair Bolsonaro, dismissed COVID-19 as a little flu. He downplayed how dangerous it was and questioned the need for lockdowns or face masks. Now, Mr. Bolsonaro has himself tested positive for COVID-19.
Muita gente, eu, por exemplo, se eu tivesse feito o exame, não saberia, né, do resultado. E ele acabou de dar positivo.
That was him wearing a mask, saying his test was positive. In front of him were a group of reporters. He gave them some more details.
Começou domingo com uma certa indisposição.
It started on Sunday and got worse during the day on Monday, with tiredness and a little muscle pain. My temperature reached 38 degrees. The presidential doctor said the symptoms suggested COVID-19, so we went for a test at the Armed Forces Hospital. My lungs are clear, but there were symptoms of the disease.
Camila Mota of BBC Brazil told us about that appearance outside the presidential palace in Brasilia.
Towards the end of the press conference, Mr. Bolsonaro took off his mask in order to show people, to show the reporters that he was looking good, that he was feeling fine. Of course, this is really not the protocol to follow if you're infected with the new coronavirus. But he did that to say that he was feeling really well and that he was really positive because he was taking hydroxychloroquine. It's a really controversial thing here in Brazil, this anti-malaria drug with no hard evidence whatsoever that it works with COVID-19 patients. But Mr. Bolsonaro is a really enthusiast of the drug, as Mr. Donald Trump is.
And now, Camilla, there's been plenty of reaction to this. The WHO, the World Health Organization, has been speaking. It shows that no country is immune, the leader of the WHO said, and no individual can be safe. Look, it also just shows that there is a collective vulnerability. I suppose what the WHO doesn't want to happen is for this to mean that Mr. Bolsonaro will carry on as normal.
Yes, but unfortunately, it seems that little will change after after his test came positive, because Mr. Bolsonaro actually said that he knew that he was vulnerable to the virus because he was a man of the people and he wouldn't give up on that, on greeting his supporters. So he said he was actually really surprised that he didn't catch the virus earlier. So I wouldn't bet that his attitude towards this pandemic would change after this.
What about the virus itself? Where is it most prevalent at the moment? Is it still in the shanty towns, and how are the hospitals coping?
Well, Brazil is a big country, so the disease is manifesting different ways in the territory. So in May and June, we saw that big capital cities went to really hard times and the situation started to get better now. And these cities are starting to open up. But at the same time, the disease is spreading inland to these small cities with really weak capacity. So that you guys have an idea, half of the Brazilian population, 100 million people, are in cities with no ICU beds at all. So that's really a concern right now.
Camila Mota. Well, let's cross to another continent now, Africa. Nigeria, its most populous country, has far fewer coronavirus cases than Brazil, just under 30,000. and there have been 600 deaths. But in common with Brazil's president, many Nigerians have perceptions of the virus which differ from mainstream medical opinion, with some even doubting that it's real. The BBC's Yemisi Adegoke witnessed the pandemic firsthand at the Lagos University Teaching Hospital.
The patients here vary in age. A few are just getting past the worst of the virus. They're sitting up, reading their Bibles or using their phones. Others are still too ill. If they need to go on a ventilator, they're sent to a different hospital. Unlike several other parts of this hospital, you can tell that the ward has been newly renovated. It's brightly lit. The beds and fixtures all look new. Successive governments have been accused of underfunding Nigeria's healthcare system. Ask the doctors here, and they'll tell you that COVID is putting a strain on a system already stretched thin. Dr. Akase has worked in infectious disease for many years, but says nothing compares to this. He's now staying in accommodation at the hospital and hasn't seen his family for nearly 2 weeks.
So when you're going home, you're thinking, okay, so this, should he have done this? Of course, then there are those that died, so you get to carry that with you.
One reason people aren't going for testing or treatment in time is because there is a belief that the virus isn't real or that its scale is being exaggerated. Such rumours gained traction after a video claiming to show an empty isolation centre was shared online.
We can see that we have about 800 people. Where are the 800 people here?
The government said the video was misleading, but on the busy streets of Lagos, many are still sceptical.
Dancing, eating, there's no corona.
They are using it to defraud the masses that were already suffering. Coronavirus is in abroad, not here in Africa.
No one that we spoke to was wearing a face covering or a mask or was adhering to social distancing. These things are mandatory by the Lagos state government. And as the numbers continue to increase, things like this are a big concern. Despite the disbelief outside, the suffering inside the wards is very real. This middle-aged woman lost her sister to complications stemming from COVID, and now both she and her nephews have been admitted with the virus. She's currently on oxygen and feeling very weak. She's visibly distressed because she's unable to bury her sister.
My sister, she's gone. I've not buried her yet. I don't know what is, why there's hope for me. I don't know.
Like many countries in the world, Nigeria is opening up again after a tough lockdown period. Millions of families were impacted by the restrictions, and Nigerians are eager for things to return to normal. But people not following safety advice makes things harder for people like Dr. Akase, for whom the pandemic is a daily reality.
This is not just among street people, ignorant people. You have seen this among educated people, people who are well-travelled. It's a real problem, and I think this will complicate efforts in our country to a large degree.
Dr. Agosi ending that report by Yemisi Adegoke in Lagos. And in what may prove to be an important shift in scientific thinking about COVID-19, the World Health Organization has acknowledged emerging evidence of the airborne spread of the virus, as well as via direct contact or droplets. Some scientists had criticized the WHO for not treating the evidence with the attention it deserved. But the WHO's Benedetta Allegranzi said the organisation believed it had been open to the evidence on modes of transmission.
We acknowledge that there is emerging evidence in this field, as in all other fields, regarding the COVID-19 virus and pandemic. And therefore, we believe that we have to be open to this evidence and understand its implications regarding the modes of transmission and also regarding the precautions that need to be taken.
Benedetta Allegranzi. The Trump administration has formally notified the United Nations that it's withdrawing America from the World Health Organization. It's due to leave on July the 6th next year. Mr. Trump has criticised the WHO's handling of the coronavirus pandemic. The director of the FBI, Christopher Wray, has said Chinese spying and other covert operations present the greatest long-term threat to the future of the United States. The BBC's John Sopel reports.
The director of the FBI is someone who typically prefers the shadows to the limelight. But today, Chris Wray surfaced with a blistering attack on what he called the criminal and malign activities of the Chinese state. It was wide-ranging, far-reaching and unsparing. The Chinese were using bribery, blackmail and covert deals, he said. They've probably stolen your data, he told Americans. Half of the agency's 5,000 active counterintelligence investigations related to China. Economic espionage cases had risen by 1,300% in the last decade, and Beijing was systematically trying to steal America's secrets. Perhaps most eye-catching of all from Mr. Ray, the allegation that the Chinese were trying to undermine US coronavirus research.
And at this very moment, China is working to compromise American healthcare organizations, pharmaceutical companies, and academic institutions conducting essential COVID-19 research.
He spoke of China's ultimate ambition.
The Chinese Communist Party believes it's in a generational fight to surpass our country in economic and technological leadership. China is engaged in a whole-of-state effort to become the world's only superpower by any means necessary.
A speech as politically sensitive as this wouldn't have happened without the blessing of the White House, and it shows just how much relations have deteriorated between the world's two superpowers. The days when Donald Trump boasted about his great relationship with President Xi and how there was a golden age of China-US relations seem long gone. Some of this is down to coronavirus. It's also about trade. But maybe the biggest part is a growing fear in the US of the strategic threat that China now presents to American preeminence.
John Sopel. The High Court in London is used to high-profile cases. But on Tuesday, there was even more media attention than usual. That's because the Hollywood star Johnny Depp gave evidence in the witness box. He's suing the publishers of The Sun newspaper and its executive editor over an article that called him a wife beater. Our reporter Charlotte Gallagher is following the case.
Johnny Depp and Amber Heard were married between 2015 and 2017, and they had a very acrimonious split. Both have accused each other of physical abuse, and both have denied those allegations. Now, this case centres around an article in the British newspaper The Sun, and it was just after Johnny Depp had been cast in a Fantastic Beasts film, which are part of the Harry Potter universe, very high-profile role. And the newspaper was questioning whether he should have got that role, given, as they described him, he was a wife beater. Now, lawyers for Johnny Depp say those allegations are completely untrue. The Sun and its publishers are saying they are true and they have the evidence that can back them up. And so we've ended up in the High Court in London today.
So what happened there? He was there, wasn't he?
Yes, Amber Heard was there and Johnny Depp was there, but it was Johnny Depp who was in the witness box today, and details of their very turbulent marriage were laid bare for journalists and members of the public who'd come to watch. Johnny Depp was questioned about his behaviour and he admitted to being a heavy drinker, taking drugs, but he said he'd never abused a woman. A video was played as well which showed him very agitated, swearing and kicking cupboards, and it turns out that both Amber Heard and Johnny Depp recorded conversations between them. So we will see more of these, we think, as the case progresses.
And potentially more high-profile witnesses in court?
Indeed, which obviously newspapers and online websites are loving. This is one of the most read stories across the world today because two very high-profile people involved. Vanessa Paradis, who was married to Johnny Depp, we're expecting her to give evidence. And Winona Ryder, who many people will know, a very famous actress. She was involved in a relationship with Johnny Depp and she's due to give evidence as well. So this case is due to go on for around 3 weeks. So lots more headlines, we think, coming out of it.
Charlotte Gallagher. You're listening to the Global News Podcast on the BBC World Service. Still to come, it could be the plot of a horror film. Sea containers converted into a torture chamber.
This chilling discovery offers an insight into the increasingly brutal Dutch criminal underworld.
Yes, not fantasy, but reality. Six men are arrested in the Netherlands. Britain is to resume arms sales to Saudi Arabia, despite claims that the weapons will be used against civilians in Yemen. That's in violation of international humanitarian law. Sales were halted in June last year after a legal challenge by campaigners who successfully argued in court that there had been repeated violations by the Saudi-led coalition since 2015. But the government says it rejects that verdict. More from Lise Doucette, our chief international correspondent.
The Secretary of State for International Trade, Liz Truss, has concluded that after using what she described as a revised methodology, we're not quite clear what that is or how much data they actually examined, how many incidents, but she came out and said that there is now no clear risk that any military equipment sold to Saudi Arabia would be involved in serious human rights abuses and breaches of international humanitarian law.
So effectively, the British government has overruled this very senior court. What's been the reaction to this from human rights groups and arms trade campaigners?
A wave of criticism, not just from human rights groups, but also from political parties in the United Kingdom, because this decision comes not long after they backed a United Nations Security Council call for a global ceasefire. And just a day after, they came out with a new approach, which was widely hailed, Global Britain for Good, in which they talked about a new sanctions regime, and some 20 members from Saudi Arabia were sanctioned for being connected to the murder of the Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. And from not just human rights groups, but people, organizations who have consistently been tracking the arms sales, especially the ones which could be used in the war in Yemen, the campaign against the arms trade, condemned it and said that there is a consistent pattern of breaches of international humanitarian law with the bombings of markets and schools and funerals.
So this is a legal, a diplomatic, a moral issue for many people. But on the ground in Yemen, what difference, if any, will it mean that British weapons can now be sold again to Saudi Arabia? Because presumably Saudi Arabia has other sources of weapons as well, doesn't it?
Saudi Arabia, of course, if they don't buy them from Britain, and they bought a lot of arms from Britain, then they could certainly turn to the United States, where President Trump is one of the biggest supporters of the Saudi government. There's no shortage of countries and organizations which want to sell arms. And I think if there was a clear signal from Britain, the critics say, then that could help. This has been such a sensitive issue for a very, very long time. And I think this decision and the outcry has just underlined that.
Lise Doucette. Mary Trump's new book about her uncle, Donald, is called Too Much and Never Enough: How My Family Created the World's Most Dangerous Man. Due to be published next Tuesday, it's already topping Amazon's best-selling list, and it's the first contribution to the collection of Trump-centred memoirs that have come from within the family. Shane Harris, intelligence and national security reporter for The Washington Post, has managed to get hold of an advance copy. Just what are the headlines?
Well, I think the headlines are here, probably the most recent ones, are that members of the Trump family believe that his bid to be president was quixotic at best. His aunt, his sister, Marianne Trump, who until recently was a prominent judge in the United States, called her brother, quote, a clown, and said, this will never happen, Mary Trump writes in the book. They believe that he had evinced racist tendencies. They thought that he was exploiting both his role in the family business as well as Mary Trump's father's memory, actually, for his political benefit. And what comes across here is, you know, a portrait in the eyes of Mary Trump of a, you know, pathological narcissist who seems to have been forged in the crucible of a home growing up that was one of neglect, one of trauma, and just an extraordinarily domineering father who Donald Trump seems to have tried to build much of his life, trying to please and ultimately to outdo.
I guess some of this, I mean, when you use words like narcissistic that come from Mary Trump, I mean, these are things that have been accusations that have been wielded at President Trump for several years now. Is there a sort of a qualitative difference in this potential damage that this could cause President Trump because it comes from within the family?
I think that's primarily the reason why, yes. I mean, it should be noted that the author has a PhD in psychological studies, but more to the point, she grew up around Donald Trump, and her father was his older brother. So this is really a look from inside the family, and what she shows is that she has a very keen eye for detail and has a way of kind of framing the family relationships and the individual members of the family as they're juxtaposed to each other, the most important characters being the father, Fred Trump Sr., his son, Freddie, as he's known, who's the author's father, and then the president. And I think that because you're seeing these behind-the-scenes moments of family dinners and Christmases, and you know, and it's not at a remove the way it is so much when we watch the president up there on the stage, it does resonate differently. Of course, this is one person's opinion, and if there are other members of the family who have already said that they disagree with her take on this, but I do think it gives it a particular resonance because it comes from someone who grew up around this man.
What pushback has there been from the White House?
Well, we've seen them essentially denounce the book and also denounce Mary Trump. They've actually, you know, the Trump Organization has moved to quiet her, and she has, I think there's a gag order effectively in place right now that prevents her from speaking about the book. They see this as a betrayal of the president, but also her father, which she would, of course, strongly disagree with. She comes across with a lot of love and sympathy for her father in the book. And they've essentially said this is somebody who is lashing back out at the family because she wasn't given the inheritance that they think that she thought that she deserved. She does write about the fact that she was given a much smaller inheritance than other members of the family. But I think she's fairly clear in what she says her motivations are, which are essentially to issue a warning to the public and to say, look, the man you see, I can explain to you where he came from and why he's like this.
Yeah, and I just wonder, Shane, I mean, if that is her purpose, do you think it will move the dial?
You know, I don't know that much moves the dial anymore, frankly, in American politics. I must say, it's a very vividly rendered portrait, and it isn't a family drama. That is, people aren't going to come away with a very different appreciation, I think, of Donald Trump. I mean, this is very much the man that we see. And so I think that given the state of polarized politics in America today, I doubt this will change anyone's minds.
Shane Harris of The Washington Post speaking to my colleague Tim Franks. They're good at gaming, they're getting better, and during lockdown, they're making money at it. Young women in Iran are amongst the best players, and subscribers pay to watch them play. I asked Sheda Hushmadi of BBC Persian why especially female gamers are seeing this boost to their morale and their pockets.
The online gaming space has become this place to socialise away from prying government eyes for many young Iranians, and especially for women. It's like the social media platforms. It's a way to stay connected to the world and to be part of the global community. I was speaking with one of these girl gamers, and she told me that she actually practices her English while she's playing with non-Iranian gamers online. Basically, gaming has become a means of making money as well. So for many women who are unemployed, as we know, unemployment for women is higher than men. It's a way of earning either an extra income or just as the main income.
And Sheda, what kind of games are we talking about here? Describe a few of them for us.
The very popular game in Iran is Fortnite, which is a basically a shooter game with multiple players. Also, we've got PUBG. It's another shooter game, yes, with loads of basically fighting strategies and loads of thinking about how to fight back, which is very popular in the Middle East specifically. And just recently, we had this news that the religious leaders, it has called as being haram or forbidden to play.
So what we're seeing in Iran is lots more women playing games because there's an incentive, a financial incentive for them to do it during the lockdown. Do you think this is going to last? Do you think the fact that people see these women playing games and they've gained the respect of their peers, is that going to last into the future, do you think?
That's what they are hoping for. It's a very good question you asked. They call themselves fighters and they carry on doing this until they change all these stereotypes in the society. They have been successful, and they are saying that now people are slightly changed to, let's say, 10 years ago, and they see things differently, and they have accepted that female can be gamers as well.
Sheda Hoshmandi of BBC Persian. Now, it could be the plot of a horror film. Sea containers converted into a makeshift prison and soundproofed torture chamber. Well, it was not a film script, and now six men have been arrested in the Netherlands after the police discovered the torture chamber. From Amsterdam, Anna Holligan has the story.
This chilling discovery offers an insight into the increasingly brutal Dutch criminal underworld involved in the production and global trafficking of drugs. A video released by police showed heavily armed officers blasting open a warehouse door and finding the improvised prison furnished with a dentist chair and tools including pliers, hedge cutters, scalpels and handcuffs. Another six containers were allegedly turned into cells where people could be tied up. Police were alerted to the site in a village close to the Belgian border via leads generated by data from encrypted phones used by criminals. They said the operation prevented a number of serious crimes. Six men have been detained on suspicion of preparing kidnappings and serious assault.
Anna Holligan. There have been lots of stories during this pandemic about distillers and brewers producing neat alcohol for hand sanitising. But one distillery in the US state of Pennsylvania has claims to an unusual, if not unique, backstory. First, its operation was entirely not for profit, and then its head distiller's grandmother used her home-distilled whiskey as a disinfectant during the Spanish flu pandemic of 1918. That head distiller is Michael Woody Dombrowski. The story stretches back to when his great-grandparents first arrived in the US from Poland.
A lot of the women were midwives or nurses, and it started with my great-grandmother. She was a midwife in the coal regions in Pennsylvania where she would make opium-based whiskey, and that was basically like a snake oil. It was a cure-all. It would cure kidney disease or arthritis, and she would drink a lot of that. In fact, she would drink so much of that, she would fall off the doctor's cart when she would be coming home treating patients. Now, my grandmother learned from her how to make it, and my grandmother distilled her rye whiskey at a very young age, and she actually financed herself going to nursing school here in Allentown.
Tell me also, though, what she used it for during the Spanish flu pandemic.
During the Spanish flu, it was, again, it was an antiseptic to her. Being in a medical field, the alcohol, the high-proof alcohol, was used to kill germs and bacteria. She would soak her gauze mask in the rye whiskey and then put it on and then go into the hospital and treat those patients who were suffering from the Spanish influenza.
Amazing. I mean, and it obviously worked for her because she survived.
She did survive. She passed away in 1981, somewhere around 83 years old, and she was still a tough old bird, as everybody called her over here.
in a complimentary fashion.
Yes.
Did you sort of think of her when your mind did turn to turning your operations into just distilling pure alcohol for hand sanitizer?
Daily. I was, you know, thinking she was up there looking down on us doing it, you know, saying how proud she is that, you know, we actually learned from her some of the ways, the old ways, and we continue to use some of the old ways and the old medicine. Another thing she would do with people who had ear infections, specifically my aunt, she had a major ear infection as a young girl in the late 1930s, where my grandmother boiled rabbit fat and poured it into her ear to actually help her regain her hearing and actually, you know, prevent her from losing her hearing.
Gosh, well, I look forward to you writing that up in the American Journal of Medicine. Just in terms of, I know that you've now gone back to your day job of distilling stuff that people can actually drink. But just in terms of how the last few months have been, I know that you uniquely, but certainly very unusually, when you and your colleagues did distill alcohol for hand sanitizer, you did it as a not-for-profit operation for the local hospital.
That is correct.
Clearly, you wanted to do the right thing, but were you concerned at all that actually, you know, you were taking a huge financial hit from this?
It comes around circle. I mean, we might have been taking a financial hit, but it's better to help the community. If there's no community out there to buy your product, what's the sense of continuing on with the product? And if you help the community and they get better, sooner or later, it's going to come around and they're going to help you and you'll get better.
Michael Woody Dombrowski speaking to the BBC's Tim Franks. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.